Is there a better earworm than that song?
It's the best. Richard Carpenter. The production on that song is just amazing. And of course, Karen Carpenter's vocal. True loss there. But, you know, a perfect song in light of the topic, not just at the top of the world for the part of the book Explorers of the Infinite that deals with climbers, but also with that sense of euphoria. And we were talking about that it seems like it could be something external that's coming. But even if it's an internal trigger where something is happening physiologically to our bodies that lets loose a part of our psyche, a part of our subconscious that we don't know that's there. Why the consistency in the experiences? What is it about us that's hardwired to produce just the right thing we need to survive? We'll talk about that more with Maria Coffey. We'll explore that story. And also, then, the characteristics of these stories, what does that really tell us about us? What does she feel she has learned from exploring the infinite? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. This is Ian Punnett. I'm broadcasting live from the Premier Radio Studios in California, and I just happened to go down the hallway, and George Norrie had his office door open, so don't tell him, but I was playing with all of his bottles of vitamins. I switched them all. I made little vitamin bottle pyramids all over his desk. So that when he comes in there, it may fall down. I don't know if it'll last until he gets back, but I think I got him up to about three or four levels. I play way too much Tetris. Maria Coffey, Explorers of the Infinite. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. And Maria, we were just kind of talking about this off the air, the idea that, isn't it interesting that you get just the experience you need in these extreme moments when the veil appears to be the thinnest between life and death, up on a mountain or out in the middle of an ocean, that you get the person, you get the vision that you need, whether it's an external or an internal response, curious that it's just the right thing that you need to keep going?
Yeah, it is curious, and I was just thinking in the break about the base jumpers that I've talked to. You know what they are? Those are people that jump off very high cliffs,
right,
or bridges, or very high buildings. They free fall and they open their parachute at the very last minute.
Which, if you looked at it, you actually think base jumpers would be people who would be jumping from a base up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like base. I never think of the top of a mountain as a base of anything. The bottom.
Base is an acronym, and it stands for...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, base. B stands for building. A stands for antennae. Because originally they used to jump from very high electrical antennae. S stands for span or bridge, and E stands for earth.
I had no idea that's what it meant.
Yeah. Now, I talked to a number of base jumpers, and one that was really interesting, and I write about him quite a lot in Explorers of the Infinite, is an English guy called Sean Ellison. And he started jumping from buildings and bridges, but he said that he very quickly graduated to only jumping from cliffs and then higher and higher cliffs. And he said that was because he needed a connection with nature. And it was that connection with nature, he said, that gave him what he called a third dimension, which made it worth him risking his life by jumping off a cliff. And he said what he would do, he'd be opening himself up to the environment, to all the energy around him. And it was by doing that he went into this different plane, that channels would open that were normally closed to him in everyday life. I think maybe the key to all this, and maybe the answer to, you know, the question that you raise, what is the consistency in all of this, is these are people that go out into the wild world, and they go out into the extremes of nature, and they take away all the insulation, the protection that we normally surround ourselves with in everyday life, you know, protect ourselves from the environment. So they're out there very vulnerable, right on the edge. And in order to survive, they really have to hone their intuition. they have to really tune into nature, just as our ancient ancestors did. So sailors have to feel the slightest change in the wind. A climber must be able to step on some snow and know what the nature of that snow is. Is it going to avalanche? You know, what does it feel like under his or her boots? Free divers will have to know, you know, have to sense if there's some sort of change in the current when they're diving. Surfers will often be able to tell exactly where a wave is going to break. So these people have this really extreme intuition, just like our ancient ancestors did by necessity. I mean, our ancient ancestors were deeply connected to their environment. They worshipped the environment. You know, it was life and death. It was every day was all about survival. So my hunch is that what these extreme adventurers are doing is rediscovering that deep, deep connection with nature. And my hunch is also is, for me anyway, or for many of these people, that's what spirituality is all about. It's about realizing our place in the world, realizing that we're part of the intricate web of life. I know I first had an inkling of this in my early 20s when I had a near-death experience when I nearly drowned. And that's the very first time I kind of felt it, maybe sort of pierce that veil a little bit. And so maybe when you do break through to that other level of consciousness, that maybe that's why there's this consistency of experience.
Yeah, and only thinking of this as a tangent to what you're saying, and not necessarily a natural connection, but that people who are addicted to auto-asphyxia in a sexual context, maybe this is also part of that. It's such a different experience that they want to keep going back to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've known two people who have died from that.
Mm-hmm.
I've known them personally and never would have thought that this was something that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so because they were the most ordinary of people that I worked with or were friends with, I keep thinking it must be such a powerful lure to find that other place, either inside of themselves or wherever they imagine that they're going.
To go so close to the edge of death.
Yeah, mm-hmm. To go so intentionally. But maybe too, and this is, I often think in life in terms of tensions, and the fact that, as you said, these explorers of the infinite go out into these places where they strip themselves of all of their creature comforts and all of the things which help define the common experience that most of us would have on a day-to-day basis, and they put themselves out on that edge so far that maybe the most natural tether to that, the anvil to their balloon, if you will, are those images of home, of mm-hmm. comfort, of those people that brought them inspiration. So maybe that's the consistency to these experiences, is that all of the things that they feel at that moment are the things that bring them the most amount of comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why they think of it's sort of like if you ask somebody to name your favorite food, and they might name pizza or, you know, hamburgers or whatever it is, that's that food that brings them the most comfort, that makes life seem like it makes the most sense while they're eating it. Maybe that's why whoever had that image of the visitation from the climber from the 1950s, that's that person that brings them the most peace about who they are under those circumstances.
Although I have heard some stories of not, you know, unfriendly spirits.
Oh, well, this is perfect then. Yes. Then who has been visited by unfriendly things?
Well, one is Dick Rutan, a very famous high-altitude, long-distance flyer. And he did the first nonstop flight around the world in the Voyager. And when he was in training for that, doing sort of a shuttling for many, many hours in a plane, I think it was in Nevada, and he'd been awake for something like 30 hours at this point, but he suddenly saw, sitting on the wing of the plane, a little elf who was basically fiddling around with part of part of the wing, and basically threatening to, you know, saying to him, you know, it's okay if you fall asleep. You can just go to sleep now. Don't worry. And, you know, so basically a very evil little elf trying to persuade him to go to sleep. And, you know, it's, and then also Carlos Corsolio, who I told you about before, when he was struggling down K2 in that terrible storm,
right,
being guided by the spirits of the mountain, he said there were also some bad entities on the mountain. It was almost like the good entities and the bad entities were arguing with each other. And some of these entities on the mountain, and they were could be rocks or patches of snow, but they suddenly became this actual physical entity giving him advice. And some of the advice that he was being given was wrong advice that would have led him to his death. So he was having to make the decision about who to listen to.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So
it's fascinating. Well, even you mentioned the gremlin story. You know, that's very close to a classic Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that makes me feel like that person saw a Twilight Zone episode. It's called Terror at 20,000 Feet, and the original black and white version of it, it's either Twilight, I think it's Twilight Zone. Yeah. Not Outer Limits. And it was, I think it was William Shatner did the original when he was a very young guy with his own hair. And then later on in the movie version of the Twilight Zone, John Lithgow did it. And it was that same idea that it was a gremlin ripping at the wings of the plane. And only one person saw it.
Well, you know, maybe because this happened a long time ago. So maybe, it was in 1979 that this happened.
Well, this still would have been the original black and white version of the Twilight Zone. Would have been from the early 60s that would have had the Terror at 20,000 feet.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. How interesting. Yeah, because now, this was in 79.
And I'm not saying it wasn't true. I'm not saying, but I just thought I'd merely make the obvious connection there for
people.
Yeah,
so maybe Dufoutin had seen that, and then that maybe that was something that came to him when he was... He'd been awake for so long.
Or maybe there's a lot more damn gremlins than I realize. Maybe they really are out there. I'm not saying that.
Yeah,
but...
because when Charles Lindbergh did the he did the first nonstop transatlantic solo flight in 1927, and he saw a lot of strange spirits and apparitions coming floating in and out of his cockpit. But he said that they were all very friendly and helpful.
What I hadn't heard about this. What type of thing would he see?
He said that they were like vaguely outlined forms, transparent. They were sort of weightless and riding with him. But they all had human voices, and they were very friendly. And he just said he saw them completely clearly, as if he was, you know, in his normal field of vision. And he believed what he said they were emanations from the experience of ages. Those are his actual words. Inhabitants of a universe closed to mortal men. And they helped him with his navigation during the hardest part of the flight, and then they disappeared.
Are you familiar with the legend of gremlins as they pertain to the RAF pilots of World War II?
No.
That might be worthy of an exploration. I don't know everything about it, but I know that that there were consistent reports by RAF pilots that there were what they like to call gremlins. I don't know whether they saw them or just experienced them or what. You would be able to find out more, but that they were always at work trying to bring mechanical troubles to the plane.
Oh.
And Raoul Dahl, right, the original spy turned children's book writer, he wrote about them. He wrote about the World War II gremlins. I think he was the first one to do that. And that they became somewhat of an unofficial mascot of World War II pilots, that sort of almost wanting to make friends with them so that they didn't hurt them. The belief that there could be those little destructive sprites out there wanting to eat and or dismantle a plane. I'll put that aside for now. Maybe later on when we get to some callers for Maria Coffey, some other people will have some comments on that. And so what do you see? Well, how do you tie things together? What do you, as you look at the overall experiences of these extreme athletes or adventurers that you have been in relationship with or communication with over the years, what do you think are the consistencies to their stories or to their experiences that lead you to at least have sort of an idea of where this falls on the spectrum of experience?
I just think it's all to do with the interconnectedness of life, and that it's as if one of the adventurers, somebody who did a very, very, very long trek across the Yukon and Alaska following a herd of porcupine caribou for 5 months, said to me that the experiences that he had on that trip were like, it was as if he'd been underwater for all his life, and then he broke the surface, and he realized for the first time there was a whole other dimension. That before that time, it was as if the surface of the water, that was the boundary of his existence, and then he broke through, and he realized that there was this whole other reality, this whole richness of existence that he'd never realized was there before. And this was a guy who's a scientist, and he went through that transformation on his long journey. And it said it was only, he basically said, you know, to survive in the modern world, you have all these blocks and filters and layers and keeping you away from that other level of reality. And that once you know it exists, there's this potential, you know, for all these other experiences, living in different ways, you know, touching, transcending to if maybe finding a portal to to another way of life, another way of existence. And so I think, you know, I think that's really what I've learned from all of this, and what maybe is the consistency of all these experiences, that somehow people are finding a portal through to another level of reality that, you know, we're told in modern life is it doesn't exist. You know, it's the rational mindset can always explain it away. But as you said at the beginning of our conversation, Ian, you know, it's anecdotal evidence, but it's a huge weight of anecdotal evidence.
Right.
Time and time again, people tell these stories, and then also, of course, you get stories from people who aren't extreme adventurers. You know, I think this is, for some people, this is one way of finding that portal, but obviously there are other ways people can find that portal.
And yet that portal just it seems to have a sort of a distinct character to it when it's experienced by these extreme athletes or adventurers.
Mm-hmm.
Or even as you talked about Charles Lindbergh, and I went to go look it up, and it says that in his book he was he recounted how he was tired and sensed misty beings in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And that these misty beings reassured him that he was safe, talked to him about navigation, and revealed mystical information.
Hmm.
And I think that's totally awesome. I want to go back and look up more on that from the original source material. But so there's somebody who's not even really having, you know, I mean, these are, again, it sort of seems like just the right thing at just the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's built into us, then that really may explain why we as a species may have evolved and continued, you know, and sort of and evolved past all other species. That if we have something that cool that's built into us genetically or physiologically that we can tap into it, maybe that's just what that's just the edge that gave us something more than either other hominids or other beings out there. I guess we'll never know whether elephants in India experienced that same exploration of the infinite, right? We won't know whether we can't tell yet whether whales experience that when they dive all the way to the bottom of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
that they're going down there and seeing mystical beings waiting for them when they get down there. But regardless of whether other species explore it, will explore it coming up. It's Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Maria Coffey, and we will continue to explore the infinite before we get to your calls. And there's kind of this whole section of the book we haven't gotten to yet. We will do that and see what more she has heard since the book originally came out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Going back into George's office to cause more mischief in the next break. Nobody tell George. He's going out of town, right? He's going to St. Louis for a week or so. So he won't even know. I don't know what I'm going to do yet. Post-it notes, key places, mess with his Rolodex. I don't know. I haven't decided yet, but it'll be my own extreme adventure coming up during the next break. We'll take your calls next hour for Maria Coffey. And I want to get back to a part of the book that we touched on it lightly, but I think it all goes around to that quote in Exploring the Infinite. Climbing is the lazy man's way to enlightenment, right? There's a tradition of enlightenment, which is just all based on suffering. It's all based on suffering. Is all of this climbing and all these base jumping, is it all just the same thing that Gandhi did, starving himself? I mean, are these all tied together, all these experiences? It's just that by extreme kayaking or something, you're having a lot more fun getting to the same place that every other mystic in history has gotten to before. They just did it in sitting in one place. There's no difference to the experience, just on the adventure in getting there. Next, we'll get to that on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Explorers of the Infinite, the book by Maria Coffey, one of many. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. And then we'll get to your calls coming up next hour. But isn't that just kind of the simple way of looking? We look at the Tibetan mystics, right? If we think about the Christian ascetics who went out into the desert and starved themselves, could it just be that just like the old expression that candy's dandy but liquor's quicker, that this is just a faster way to get to that same place that self-denying shaman of various type have been to before?
I totally agree. I'm not sure if it's a faster way, though, because many of these people, you know, the way that they train, it's almost like they're putting them through the same rigors that those ancient mystics put themselves through. I mean, if you think about Lance Armstrong, I mean, the kind of training that cyclists like him do, and he says, you know, for him, suffering is absolutely essential, that if he doesn't suffer, it isn't worth it, and that, you know, after an incredibly long ride, he feels cleansed. And then, you know, some of these, let's look at, for example, the free divers, the people who dive to great depths in the ocean on one breath. I mean, they, you know, the suffering that they go through when they're both training, when they're on these dives, you know, holding their breath up to about 7 minutes, and then, you know, diving down, and they get terrible cramps, they get terrible pains in their ears, they get flashed by jellyfish. You think about some of the training that some of the climbers go through. Mark Twite, a famous American alpinist, told me that when he was training for his really difficult ice climbs, he used to plunge his hands into freezing cold water. He used to beat his hands against concrete until they bled to get ready for the ice climbing. He used to run stairs until he vomited. Marshall Ulrich, who's an ultra marathoner, he runs on the spot for hours in a sauna to get ready for the long races across Death Valley. You know, I mean, these people really put themselves through it, you know.
Well, and yet then can't we just say, but I don't mean to put words in any of these people's mouths, but as you were talking before about the Burgess twins, right? And that one saw himself as being not inclined to believe in divine experiences, and the other one did. The other one was studying those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But that many climbers might not think of themselves as self-punishing monks.
I don't think they think of themselves as self-punishing monks, but every one of these athletes that I've talked to sees the necessity of suffering, sees the necessity of hard work to reach a place of peace.
But again, I mean, just think about the monks that practice flagellation. Right, who had whips with pieces of glass or with little bits of metal on the end, and it became under the guise of penance, like many of the athletes might just think of themselves as just, you know, under the guise of sport, but that it's all the same kind of extreme mortification of their own flesh. That they're just using different instruments. That the flagellants of the 15th century would hit themselves until they bled, until they passed out, but they would have these amazing experiences and a sense of a connection to the divine. And they might end up even losing flesh, but that's not unlike any of many of these climbers that end up losing the tips of their nose or their fingers or their toes.
I suppose the difference is there's sort of a connection to nature that maybe the mystics didn't have. I mean, they were sort of directly trying to, I guess, trying to have a fast track to God, you know, and whereas these people are going out into the wild world, which is, although many of the mystics did that too, of course.
Yeah. You know,
they went into the deserts, they climbed mountains. One of my favorite quotes actually is from an Inuit shaman who said, "All true wisdom is only to be found far from the dwellings of men in the great solitudes and only attained through suffering." And he was one of these people that would go out into the ice and be sealed up into an igloo for a month at a time with very little water and hardly any clothes, you know.
Right.
He knew what he was talking about.
Right. And how similar that sounds to somebody in a tent somewhere high up on Mount Everest.
Or crossing the wastes of the polar ice cap.
Right. And
three months at a time hauling sleds.
Right. And how similar that is, these suffering monks, these people who are putting themselves in these extreme circumstances, they have visions of saints.
Mm-hmm.
They have visions of the monks that have the brothers that they have lost from the monastery that come back to speak to them. I mean, it seems to me like it's a direct connection.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And, you know, I was the mountaineer that I was together with for a number of years back in the 80s, Joe Tasker, had spent his teenage years in a Jesuit seminary training to be a priest and left when he was 20 years old, actually. And I often used to think, you know, that maybe he'd somehow been hardwired to need a level of suffering in order to feel fulfilled and at peace. And he totally denied it. And yet it was very much the case. You know, he would go off to the high mountains and put himself through a level of deprivation that most of us would find absolutely intolerable, living on the side of a mountain, you know, living without oxygen,
right,
very high altitude. And yet he needed to do that in order to feel whole.
Well, or cleansed, if we go back to the Lance Armstrong word, which is just how flagellants of the, which sounds remarkably close to the word flatulent, and I'll be very clear, the flagellants of the 15th century or 14th century that did this self-mortification, that these largely men, male groups, did this as a way of purifying themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the same thing Lance Armstrong says. I mean, it's sort of really interesting that's where they both end up, just in, and along the way, maybe a little less blood with Lance Armstrong, but certainly no less blood with a lot of the other extreme athletes with whom you've spoken.
But, you know, I mean, it's I'm just thinking of Marshall Ulrich again, who's the ultramarathoner, who runs these incredibly long races. You know, he runs across Death Valley. He's done the Eco Challenge 9 times. You know, he just really, really pushes himself. I mean, during one of the Eco Challenges that he did, he was existing on like about 15 minutes of sleep a night for 5 nights in a row. And, you know, when I asked him why does he put himself through all this suffering, it was clear that he feels it has a really profound purpose. And he said that it elevates his senses and it allows him to tap into other resources. And he reaches very special places in his mind and his body, in that afterwards he thinks, well, how can I get back to that special place?
Right.
He gets back to it by going and again pushing himself to the limit in these incredibly long races.
The same things are said by those people who, and I'm not recommending this, but those people who participate in crucifixions. Well, they do. I mean, they feel like every year they want to go back to that place again.
I haven't heard about people who participate in crucifixions.
Oh, you don't know this? Oh.
No, I don't think I want to know that.
In the Philippines,
oh, goodness.
And it's sort of an annual Easter tradition in many cultures.
Mm. But you know, I do think there's a difference, Ian. I think there's, you know, I have to, I feel, you know, there's a part of me that has this sort of knee-jerk reaction to that. Because
sure.
Because what these people are doing as well, I mean, there is a great joy in it as well. They are out in nature. They're having this very, very deep connection with the natural world, and that's what allows them to survive. And, you know, as I was talking about before, you know, they hone their senses. You know, they have this real deep connection with nature, with a wild environment. And I think there's the difference, you know.
Well, you know, before you throw out the idea completely, sometime if you ever get a chance to take a look at some of the quotes from the people who do this annual horrible thing, as far as I'm concerned, but the people that have themselves crucified and see whether there aren't any similarities. Maybe if they all were in the same room, you know, sharing a beer, you might be surprised at what they might say. Oh, yeah, me too. But fair enough. I understand the nature piece is big on this, and that is another way that people sort of see themselves as being on a larger altar.
But maybe it's also a closeness to death. I mean, there's, you know, a woman that I've talked to at length recently who suffered a stroke. And then afterwards read Explorers of the Infinite and contacted me. This is a friend of mine who came with us on one of our Hidden Places trips to the Solomon Islands some years ago. And after she read, she came to my book launch in New York. She read the book. She'd had the stroke the previous year. And then she contacted me and she said she couldn't believe it because of the parallels of her experiences when she was having her stroke and during her recovery with the experiences of the extreme adventurers.
Hmm.
And, you know, she said it was so powerful that she'd read a paragraph and have to put the book down.
Hmm.
She said, you know, some of the parallels were that every one of her senses were she was hyper-aware of everything. She lost her sense of self. It wasn't about, you know, the me anymore. She just became like an energy being. She went into a state of extreme bliss at times, you know, when she felt really kind of connected or sort of interconnection with the universe, with everyone around her. And she said it's an experience that she really wants to attain again, but she doesn't know how to get it. She doesn't want to go through the stroke experience again. She
sure.
doesn't want to cling to the side of a mountain.
Right.
But it made her really understand why these people long to go back, you know, or keep going back to these extreme adventures, because she's realized that what they're trying to get at is that altered state of being that she went into when she was very close to death.
Well, not to push the point past one more question, but are there holy relics amongst these extreme adventurers or athletes? Do they hold on to certain talismans or souvenirs of these extreme spiritual experiences that...
Oh, absolutely.
See, now I'm back to putting these two things back together again. Tell me about the holy relics of the explorers of the infinite.
Well, one free diver that I talked to, there's one particular, Mandy Ray Cruikshank, there's one particular... When they're free diving in competition, they're a little... They have to dive, let's say they dive to 400 feet on one breath, and then there's a tag that they have to take from the bottom of the dive. It's attached to a rope, and then they have to go back up with it to prove that they actually, you know, got to that depth. And there's one particular tag that she kept from one competition, and that's her talisman. She takes it with her everywhere.
Hmm.
And, you know, and she said when she gets up in the morning before a competition, there's a certain routine in which she gets dressed, how she makes her breakfast. You know, she's very superstitious about doing things in a certain way. But the climbers in particular, many of them that I talk to, what they take to the mountain with them that they think keeps them safe. I mean, one climber, and this really touched me, one climber takes a shoe that his son wore when the son was a baby, tiny little shoe, and he always takes the shoe to the top of the mountain. And when he's leaving on a climb, his son always says, "Daddy, make sure you bring the shoe back." There's another American climber I talked to whose daughter, when he was climbing, his daughter would always give him a teddy bear and say, "Make sure you bring the teddy bear back." So he would take that teddy bear with him to the top of the mountain, and it would always remind him that he had to keep safe and he had to come back. Another climber, Ed Vistas, whenever he has what he calls his juju bag when he goes climbing, mm-hmm. in that there's two little bracelets that his babies wore in the hospital when they were born, a postcard that his wife once sent him, a lucky playing card. Again, these talismans that as long as he has them with him, he feels that will keep him safe. And it links back to what you said before about the spirits that appear to them. These are all things that are linked to home, that they feel if they have these things with them, somehow these things will draw them home safely to their loved ones.
One person's superstition is another person's religious ritual. So, you know, so let me push the idea of relic a little bit further. Holy relics, not just of their own experience, but are there holy relics of climbing or of climbers or divers or explorers who have gone before them who have died, where it's still considered a ritual, say, like in some religious circles, where one might one is expected to, say, crawl on one's knees up to an icon of a saint, and or that one is supposed to burn a candle in front of a particular triptych in a cathedral. Are there religious or holy relic sites for climbers, for extreme athletes, where one is expected to do something to connect themselves to the divinity of the experience?
I think surfers have some beautiful rituals like that. Now, it's somewhere in Hawaii where there's a competition that happens every year. And at the beginning, the surfers go out and form a circle. And I think they throw flowers into the water, you know, and this is like an offering to Mother Ocean.
Mm.
Surfers have a very, very deep connection to the ocean. And I think of all the extreme adventurers, they're the most animistic in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's possibly because there's a very deep spiritual history to surfing. You know, it came from the Polynesians and then the Hawaiians who very much worship the ocean, worship the spirits of the ocean. So even to, for example, when the early Hawaiians were making the first surfboards, they'd cut down a certain tree, but they'd always then bury a fish, you know, in the base of it, and from where they'd pulled up the tree, they'd give an offering of a fish to the spirit of the tree, you know. So there's this very, very deep spiritual connection, which, you know, I think, you know, just about the free divers as well. I remember talking to Tanya Streeter, you know, and she always speaks to the ocean before a dive, gives thanks to the ocean after a dive. So there's a, and again, it's a connection to the earth, to the environment.
It is, and yet how do I say this without being disrespectful of other people's religious traditions, that they are projecting onto the environment the same anthropomorphization of God that other people, say, would accuse Judeo-Christians of doing, that they are honoring it, but they're really doing almost the exact same thing as all other religions. They're identifying a different a body of seawater as opposed to a body of holy water, if you know what I mean.
Well, I don't think it matters where you find your spirituality or where you find your God, you know, as long as it's all about finding a deep peace and finding a level of goodness in yourself and others. And you know, I mean, I think no matter how you find it, it's finding it. It's making that connection that's the important thing.
Isn't that the dichotomy, though, of the exploring the infinite? Is it, are you finding your God or are you finding God in these extreme adventures? Is it something deeply personal, or is it something that you're achieving that's extra personal? We'll leave it there for the moment. We'll get back to your calls coming up last hour with Maria Coffey next on Coast to Coast AM.